Good evening.
Yeah. Mm.
Tonight we begin the fifth chapter in Book Two of the Life Divine. The Cosmic Illusion, Mind, Dream, and Hallucination. So, he's given you the clue right at the beginning that while this is a large and universal question, he's coming at this from a position that is familiar to us now, one in which personal experience as an index to reality is paramount. Mind, dream, and hallucination, we know best because they form part of our own experience, our own psychological being. And as always, he opens with citations from Vedantic sources, the Gita and two Upanishads. The first verse, "Thou who hast come to this transient and unhappy world, turn to me. Anityam asukam lokam." Anityam, transient. What is not eternal? What does not last? Asukam, what is not happy? What is not felicitous? And the world, of course, lokam. Turn to me. But the verb is bhajasva. It means something more than just turn to me. It means embrace me. This root, which is at the foundation of the term bhakti, means to attach oneself to grasp. Well, you grasp it because you love it. So don't love this ephemeral and suffering world. Love me. Come to me, to the divine. So says Krishna, speaking as Purushottama in the Gita. The next is a long citation from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the great forest treatise. What's interesting is that in the previous verse to the one Sri Aurobindo cites here, Yajñavalkya, the great sage, has declared to Janaka, the great king, that the self itself is its own light. Everything is lit up from within. The experience of the pure self behind the play of nature is that which gives illumination. That is real illumination. That is the real light. The Upanishad, which is the oldest of all the Upanishads and by far the most vast, continues then. This is a dialogue between Janaka and Yajñavalkya. This self is a self of knowledge, vijñanamaya, an inner light in the heart, hridya andar jyotihi purusha. He is the conscious being, the purusha, common to all the states of being, and moves in both worlds. He becomes a dream self and passes beyond this world and its forms of death. There are two planes, states, sthana, of this conscious being, this and the other worlds. A third state is their place of joining, the state of dream. And when he stands in this place of their joining, sandhyam, he sees both planes of his existence, this world and the other world. When he sleeps, he takes the substance of this world, matra, in which all is, and himself undoes and himself builds by his own illumination, his own light. When this conscious being sleeps, he becomes luminous with his self-light, Swayam Jyoti. There are no roads, nor chariots, nor joys, nor pleasures, nor tanks, nor ponds, nor rivers, but he creates them by his own light, for he is the maker. By sleep, swapnena, he casts off his body, and unsleeping sees those that sleep. He preserves by his life breath, pranena, this lower nest, and goes forth immortal from his nest. Immortal, he goes where he wills, the golden Purusha, the solitary swan, Hiranmaya Purusha, Ekasahamsa. They say, the country of waking only is his, for the things which he sees when awake, these only he sees when asleep. But there he is his own self-light, so says Yajnavalkya. In other words, he insists that the light of the inner self exists apart from all other considerations and is not merely duplicative of our outer experience. It gives light. And when you know that, you are free. You stand between these worlds, in a sense, linking them all together. You can see above into that transcendent source of your own and the world's nature. You see below. You see those who sleep. To the outer eye, some may look at you. You have put down this little nest. You have secured it, and you've gone forth to enjoy and venture forth in the world. But you can see radiantly above. You can see penetratingly below. And you traverse these worlds. The Taittiriya Upanishad has a similar verse in it. How the freed soul roams through the worlds enjoying. Enjoying, because it's all for delight. Not asukam. Not anityam. But figuring what is eternal here in time. Figuring that transcendent delight here in the vagaries of existence, which finally reveal themselves to be a delightful existence. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Interesting, Sri Aurobindo never translated this Upanishad in full and only dealt with some of its verses. So interesting that here, as he composes this chapter for inclusion in an expanded book form of the Life Divine, he selects this at a critical passage in the book. Because here, in his treatment of our conscious experience of the world, whether it is or whether it is not, he has to take up Shankara and his non-dualistic view of things and arrive at what he would consider to be a greater non-dualism, one that includes and incorporates and embraces the world. And Shankara, of course, made his reputation on his interpretation of the Upanishads and also the Brahma Sutras. Sri Aurobindo, by the by, seems never to have looked at Shankara's work in the Brahma Sutras, but knows him through his commentary on the Upanishads. So this ought to be a very interesting chapter. We have one more to read from. From the Prashna Upanishad, the Upanishad of Questions. What is seen and what is not seen? What is experienced and what is not experienced? What is and what is not? All it sees. It is all and sees. Sarvam Pashyati. Sarvaha Pashyati. That is how he has introduced us to this chapter on the cosmic illusion. And he begins. All human thought, all mental man's experience, moves between a constant affirmation and negation. There is for his mind no truth of idea, no result of experience that cannot be affirmed, none that cannot be negated. It has negated the existence of the individual being, negated the existence of the cosmos, negated the existence of any immanent or underlying reality, negated any reality beyond the individual and the cosmos. But it is also constantly affirming these things, sometimes one of them solely, or any two, or all of them together. So this will be an explanation of how the human mind assesses its experience of self and world, and that philosophy has ultimately come to reject the reality successively and sometimes altogether of the individual, because he's transient, the universe, and the transcendence beyond the universe, one or all. But Sri Aurobindo understands the nature of the mind, and he says then, it has to do so, because our thinking mind is in its very nature an ignorant dealer in possibilities, not possessing the truth behind any of them, but sounding and testing each in turn, or many together, if so perchance it may get at some settled belief or knowledge about them, some certitude. Yet, living in a world of relativities and possibilities, it can arrive at no final certainty, no absolute and abiding conviction. Even the actual, the realized, can present itself to our mentality as a maybe or may not be, siadva na siadva, which is from the philosophy of Jainism, or as an is under the shadow of the might not have been, and wearing the aspect of that which will not be hereafter. So the mind is a dubious organism, I should say a dubious organ, and arrives itself at dubiety. Our life being is also afflicted by the same incertitude. It can rest in no aim of living from which it can derive a sure or final satisfaction, or to which it can assign an enduring value. Our nature starts from facts and actualities, which it takes for real. It is pushed beyond them into a pursuit of uncertain possibilities, and led eventually to question all that it took as real. For it proceeds from a fundamental ignorance and has no hold on assured truth. All the truths on which it relies for a time are found to be partial, incomplete, and questionable. At the outset, man lives in his physical mind, which perceives the actual, the physical, and the objective, and accepts it as fact, and this fact as self-evident truth beyond question. Whatever is not actual, not physical, not objective, it regards as unreal or unrealized, only to be accepted as entirely real when it has succeeded in becoming actual, becoming a physical fact, becoming objective. Its own being, too, it regards as an objective fact, warranted to be real by its existence in a visible and sensible body. All other subjective beings and things it accepts on the same evidence insofar as they can become objects of our external consciousness or acceptable to that part of the reason which builds upon the data supplied by that consciousness and relies upon them as the one solid basis of knowledge. Physical science is a vast extension of this mentality. It corrects the errors of the sense and pushes beyond the first limitations of the sense mind by discovering means of bringing facts and objects not seizable by our corporeal organs into the field of objectivity. But it has the same standard of reality, the objective, the physical actuality. Its test of the real is possibility of verification by positive reason and objective evidence. So this is the way the mind working in physicality operates. Even potentiality it can ignore until it becomes bodily visible before it, because it is of questionable certainty whether it will or will not come into being. Probability means nothing to the physical mind. It wants actual evidence in front of it, which it can touch and measure. Sri Aurobindo continues, "But man also has a life mind, a vital mentality, which is an instrument of desire. This is not satisfied with the actual. It is a dealer in possibilities. It has the passion for novelty and is seeking always to extend the limits of experience for the satisfaction of desire, for enjoyment, for an enlarged self-affirmation and aggrandizement of its terrain of power and profit. It desires, enjoys, possesses actualities. But it hunts also after unrealized possibilities, is ardent to materialize them, to possess and enjoy them also. It is not satisfied with the physical and objective only, but seeks, too, a subjective, an imaginative, a purely emotive satisfaction and pleasure. If there were not this factor, the physical mind of man, left to itself, would live like the animal, accepting his first actual physical life and its limits as his whole possibility, moving in material nature's established order and asking for nothing beyond it. But this vital mind, this unquiet life will, comes in with its demands and disturbs this inert or routine satisfaction which lives penned within the bounds of actuality. It enlarges always desire and craving, creates a dissatisfaction, an unrest, a seeking for something more than what life seems able to give it. It brings about a vast enlargement of the field of physical actuality by the actualization of our unrealized possibilities, but also a constant demand for more and always more, a quest for new worlds to conquer, an incessant drive towards an exceeding of the bounds of circumstance and a self-exceeding." So its quest may be ignorant, but we can see the hint here of what we will soon see as its great utility to striving humanity. To add to this cause of unrest and incertitude, there comes in a thinking mind that inquires into everything, questions everything, builds up affirmations and unbuilds them, erects systems of certitude, but finally accepts none of them as certain, affirms and questions the evidence of the senses, follows out the conclusions of the reason, but undoes them again to arrive at different or quite opposite conclusions, and continues indefinitely, if not ad infinitum, this process. This is the history of human thought and human endeavor, a constant breaking of bounds, only to move always in the same spirals, enlarged perhaps, but following the same or constantly similar curves of direction. The mind of humanity, ever seeking, ever active, never arrives at a firmly settled reality of life's aims and objects, or at a settled reality of its own certitudes and convictions, an established foundation or firm foundation of its idea of existence. So, as we've seen, he finds that whether it is the human consciousness based in the body, or the human consciousness questing through its vitality, or the human consciousness examining things up close, it is restless and takes these signs of the inadequacy of life and existence to be a signature of an impermanence which it can find no foundation on. So let's go forward. At a certain point of this constant unrest and travail, even the physical mind loses its conviction of objective certitude and enters into an agnosticism which questions all its own standards of life and knowledge, doubts whether all this is real, or else whether all, even if real, is not futile. The vital mind, baffled by life and frustrated or else dissatisfied with all its satisfactions, overtaken by a deep disgust and disappointment, finds that all is vanity and vexation of spirit and is ready to reject life and existence as an unreality, all that it hunted after as an illusion, Maya. The thinking mind, unbuilding all its affirmations, discovers that all are mere mental constructions, and there is no reality in them, or else that the only reality is something beyond this existence, something that has not been made or constructed, something absolute and eternal. All that is relative, all that is of time, is a dream, a hallucination of the mind, or a vast delirium, an immense cosmic illusion, a delusive figure of apparent existence. So each aspect of our compressed, evolving, yet still ignorant being reaches this point, an agnosticism in the physical mind, a disappointment, a rejection of the world by the vital mind, and disregarding illusionism, which the thinking mind interprets the universe to be. And then, the principle of negation prevails over the principle of affirmation and becomes universal and absolute. It is easier to say no. Thence arise the great world-negating religions and philosophies. Thence, too, a recoil of the life motive from itself, and a seeking after a life elsewhere, flawless and eternal, or a will to annul life itself in an immobile reality or an original non-existence. If this experience will be inadequate and frustrating and limited and transient, then let us seek a greater life. Let us strike through this illusion and throw ourselves into that which is beyond, into a reality which is immobile. Or, if we don't really exist, let us accept our non-existence and plunge into it. Let us leap into the abysm and negate self and world altogether. In India, the philosophy of world negation has been given formulations of supreme power and value by two of the greatest ever thinkers, Buddha and Shankara. Buddha left his body, let us say, around 385 BCE. The dates have been recently revised. and Shankara left his body around 820 CE. There had been, intermediate or later in time, other philosophies of considerable importance, some of them widely accepted, formulated with much acumen of thought by men of genius and spiritual insight, which disputed with more or less force and success the conclusions of these two great metaphysical systems. But none has been put forward with an equal force of presentation or drive of personality or had a similar massive effect. The spirit of these two remarkable spiritual philosophies, for Shankara, in the historical process of India's philosophical mind, takes up, completes, and replaces Buddha, has weighed with the tremendous power on her thought, religion, and general mentality. Everywhere broods its mighty shadow. Everywhere is the impress of the three great formulas. The chain of karma. Escape from the wheel of rebirth. Maya. It is necessary, therefore, to look afresh at the idea or truth behind the negation of cosmic existence, and to consider, however briefly, what is the value of its main formulations or suggestions, on what reality they stand, how far they are imperative to the reason or to experience. For the present, it will be enough to throw a regard on the principal ideas which are grouped around the conception of the great cosmic illusion, Maya, or to set against them those that are proper to our own line of thought and vision. For both proceed from the conception of the one reality, but one line leads to a universal illusionism, the other to a universal realism, an unreal or real unreal universe reposing on a transcendent reality, or a real universe reposing on a reality at once universal and transcendent or absolute. And I think you know where he will plump. It will be the latter. So we began with declarations from the Gita, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and the Prashna Upanishad. You can see that Brihadaranyaka has a fundamentally realistic perspective, even though it rests upon the experience of the self as self-lit. The original Upanishadic vision was one of a reality which is everywhere. This is true in the Brihadaranyaka, it is true also in the Isha Upanishad, in the Mundaka Upanishad, in virtually every Upanishad that you can pick up, which is among the original 13, let's say. The world is not canceled out by any of them. There is no great emphasis placed on a rejection of life in any of the Upanishads. Yajñavalkya, the great sage, has himself two wives, takes unto himself 1,000 head of cattle, says yes with courage, with profound wisdom. We see no asceticism in the original formulation of Vedanta. It is when we get to Jainism, to Buddhism, and to Shankara who follows and establishes mutts which still stand in their splendor to this day, that the rejection of the world becomes associated with Indian spirituality. Mighty psychologists and philosophers were Buddha and Shankara. We will pause our study here tonight because there is much to come, and it being Mother's Day, I give you leave this evening to enjoy. But when we return, we will begin to focus on some of these arguments, and I may send to you by email some selections from the works of Shankaracharya so that you can see translated into English the force of his logic and the nature of his position. Before we go, I want to clear one thing up. Shankara is not rejecting the value or the validity of the Upanishads. In fact, his entire philosophy is based upon the verity of the Upanishads, of the Shruti. In fact, that is his starting point. For Sri Aurobindo, the touchstone is the personal experience, cutting through all to get to the basis of the divine reality. When you have experienced authentically and you know directly, then you can write authentically. You can formulate a philosophy that captures something of that essence. And so Sri Aurobindo has founded his argument in the life divine. Shankara's position is different. He looks at the Upanishads and says, the Upanishads are right, and I begin my argument from there. It is interesting that when he challenges Buddhism to come forth with your own arguments, he insists that they base their arguments completely on reason, when he has based his on the foundation of a written text, or a spoken text, let us say. We'll come back to this next week, but I found a passage that I think you'll see is relevant to our study tonight. It's in Book 2, Canto 5 in Savitri. He is satisfied with his common average kind. Tomorrow's hopes and his old rounds of thought, his old familiar interests and desires, he has made into a thick and narrowing hedge, defending his small life from the invisible. His being's kinship to infinity he has shut away from him into inmost self, fenced off the greatnesses of hidden God. His being was formed to play a trivial part in a little drama on a petty stage. In a narrow plot, he has pitched his tent of life beneath the wide gaze of the starry vast. He is the crown of all that has been done. Thus is creation's labor justified. This is the world's result, nature's last poise. And if this were all, and nothing more were meant, if what now seems were the whole of what must be, if this were not a stage through which we pass on our road from matter to eternal self, to the light that made the worlds, the cause of things, well might interpret our mind's limited view, existence as an accident in time, illusion or phenomenon or freak, the paradox of a creative thought which moves between unreal opposites, inanimate force struggling to feel and know, matter that chanced to read itself by mind, in conscience monstrously engendering soul. At times all looks unreal and remote. We seem to live in a fiction of our thoughts, pieced from sensation's fanciful traveler's tale, or caught on the film of the recording brain, a figment or circumstance in cosmic sleep. A somnambulist walking under the moon, an image of ego treads through an ignorant dream, counting the moments of a spectral time. In a false perspective of effect and cause, trusting to a specious prospect of world space, it drifts incessantly from scene to scene, whither it knows not, to what fabulous verge. All here is dreamed or doubtfully exists, but who the dreamer is and whence he looks is still unknown or only a shadowy guess. Or the world is real, but ourselves too small, insufficient for the mightiness of our stage. A thin life curve crosses the titan whirl of the orbit of a soulless universe, and in the belly of the sparse rolling mass, a mind looks out from a small casual globe and wonders what itself and all things are. And yet, to some interned subjective sight that strangely has formed in matter's sightless stuff, a pointillage minute of little self takes figure as world being's conscious base. Such is our scene in the half-light below. This is the sign of matter's infinite. This, the weird purport of the picture shown to science, the giantess, measurer of her field, as she pores on the record of her close survey and mathematizes her huge external world, to reason bound within the circle of sense, or in thought's broad impalpable exchange, a speculator in tenuous vast ideas. Abstractions in the void her currency, we know not with what firm values for its base. Only religion in this bankruptcy presents its dubious riches to our hearts, or signs unprovisioned checks on the beyond. Our poverty shall there have its revenge. Our spirits depart, discarding a futile life into the blank unknown, or with them take death's passport into immortality. Don't fret, he is being masterfully poetic. This is not, again, his view of us or the world. Some. Until next week, when we meet Adi Shankaracharya. Namaste, Jai Ma.